From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, some context for the wildfire season that smoked up Michigan's air quality.
So I worry that we might be underestimating how bad it will get and how soon it will get really bad.
Also, too much of a good thing on the UP's Narnia Trail. Thousands of new visitors are taking their toll.
This little tiny trail in the eastern UP went from seeing about 5,000 visitors a year to as many as an estimated 50,000 visitors.
And Congresswoman Haley Stevens joins us in studio with a wide-ranging interview ahead of the August primary for a U.S. Senate seat.
Data centers are being built off of the backs of our hard work and our taxpayer dollars, and our rates are only going up, and it's not acceptable.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on this hour, we'll launch a pair of interviews with the leading candidates in Michigan's Democratic primary for a U.S. Senate seat. First up, it's Congresswoman Haley Stevens.
It's also the time to be engaging in our country's democracy, the deliberations for who's going to stand up and fight for us. I think this has been a really healthy and incredible process. It's been important for Democrats as well.
Stevens is running against Abdul El-Sayed in the August primary. We'll be hearing from him tomorrow. Today, it's Stevens on everything from relations with Israel to healthcare to affordability. Stay tuned. That's coming up later this hour. But first, a quick correction before we dive in. On Monday, we spoke with a reporter about Representative Sri Tanadar's deep campaign financing from AIPAC and his about-face on matters with Israel. Our guest misspoke about Tanadar's voting record. Last week, Tanadar voted against a measure that would strip U.S. support for Israel. In other words, his vote was for maintaining support of Israel. He was in a slim majority of Democrats who also voted that way. Michigan's northern neighbor is in the midst of yet another historically heavy wildfire season, and the resulting smoke has coated Michigan with an apocalyptic haze that made outdoor conditions dangerous for several days last week. North American wildfires, a constant and very normal part of forest ecosystems, are looking very different today than they have in past decades. Jonathan Overpeck is dean of the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. His research in climate science has covered every continent except Antarctica. And in 2007, he shared a Nobel Peace Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which published a paper predicting lower living standards and more conflict as a result of rising temperatures worldwide. Jonathan Overpeck, welcome to Stateside.
My pleasure to be here.
The geologic record suggests that mega droughts have happened at points in Earth's history before Europeans were ever on this continent. What's important to know about the precursors of this mega drought in terms of changes in the Earth's climate?
Yeah, I mean, I study ancient climates. That's my big thing. And I like to study it in ways that are reveal clues and lessons for what's going to come next in the future. And one of the interesting things is that the Southwest, the West, has always seen mega droughts. And by mega droughts, just to be clear, I mean droughts that last more than a couple decades, more than 20 years. And the last time we saw a whole bunch of mega droughts was during a period that was a little warmer in North America, medieval times. And it was a little warmer, not a lot warmer, not as warm as it is now, probably. But nonetheless, we saw more mega droughts. And what that says to me is that the Earth system is very sensitive. It doesn't take a lot of warming to start getting drier conditions. And the longest drought we've seen out west occurred during Roman times. And that's another period when we think it was a little warmer in North America and more generally around the Northern Hemisphere. So it's quite possible that our computer models that we use to project future climates are actually not sensitive enough to changes, subtle changes in climate forcing. And what we're doing with burning of fossil fuels is not subtle either. It's like hitting the climate system with a big hammer. Whereas in the past, we hit it with little taps. Now we're really hitting it with a big hammer. So I worry that we might be underestimating how bad it'll get and how soon it will get really bad.
Part of what has changed our understanding, I think, of wildfire season and particulates and the warming that's made this possible, I think, comes from our phones. People are able to see videos from fire season in the West, even if they're living in parts of the country that haven't experienced this yet. The heightened risks during wildfire season are not new if you live in the West, but this is a new experience for a lot of people here in Michigan who may have only seen this kind of smoke spreading into our area within the past 5 years or so. Do you worry that people in this region may be less aware of what is going on and maybe less in tune to some of the conversations that have been happening in Western states where fire season has just been so destructive?
Sure. Out west, everybody, I think, even if, they might be politically trying to ignore it, but everyone knows the climate is changing. I mean, it's so obvious. It's gotten so much hotter. And the wildfires are really a clear example. And it's intuitive for humans, I think, to realize that when you get warmer temperatures, really hot temperatures, the vegetation dries out and wilts unless you water it more. And that drying out of the vegetation is what makes it so susceptible to burning. We're basically turning vegetation into fuel for fires. So out west, it's just common sense that these warmer temperatures are going to drive more wildfire, bigger wildfires, more severe wildfires, and therefore a lot more smoke. And we're just used to smelling and seeing fires and smoke out west. So here we are in Michigan, where, yes, there have been huge fires here, like when we burned down Chicago. But those fires were really the result of dry conditions and human-caused ignitions. And the fires we're going to get in the future are going to be more like the ones out west, caused by the warming climate, slowly drying out our vegetation, our forests, and then they too will start to burn. But I think in Michigan, I'm sort of sensing people understand climate change. We're getting record temperatures, we're getting extreme temperatures, we're getting heat waves, we're getting more and more flooding, and we're getting these dry conditions in summer that have caused our agricultural industry, a very, I think, potent and important industry in Michigan, to go to irrigated agriculture. You have the growers of fruit having to grow more orchards to be sustainable because the climate is just getting harder to grow fruit, harder to grow crops. So you have to start adapting to that. So more and more, I think Michiganders are understanding something's up with our climate. And the wildfire smoke is just a little explanation point. If anyone said, "Well, whoa, it's smoky out. Where's that smoke coming from?" I think it's pretty hard to ignore what's going on up in Canada, where you're getting fires from the eastern edge of the country all the way west, all the way up into the far north. It's just burning like crazy up there. And it's just kind of common sense that the reason for that is you're getting warmer temperatures and it's drying out the vegetation and making it ripe for fire.
Four members of Michigan's congressional delegation, Jack Bergman, John Molinar, Lisa McClain, and John James, who is also he's a congressman, but he's also running for governor in Michigan this year. They wrote a letter to Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney this week, and they actually did acknowledge the danger of particulate pollution in the air from the smoke. But they also suggested that the fires are a product of bad forest maintenance and that Canada needs to do more. Can I just ask about your reaction to that?
Well, there's a lot of politics involved here. When President Trump was running for office, he literally said on the campaign trail, if the big oil companies of the country gave him money, he'd do whatever they want. And what they want is to play down climate change. And so, he's got the whole party now essentially singing a tune that climate change is not a big deal. When it comes to forest management, there is a lot we could do to reduce wildfire risk and ultimately the wildfires, particularly in the United States, where we can drive to the forests, we can fly over them easily. The problem in Canada is that many of these forests are completely inaccessible. You can't get to them. I mean, you can fly to them, but you can't drive to them. So the idea that, it's all about forest management is a little crazy. Forest management can help, but the big driver of this increase in forest fire is the warming, is climate change. And so the United States and Canada have a rich record of working together on forest fire and forest management. They send resources to the US when we need it, and vice versa. And by resources, I mean, tanker planes and firefighters. And these men and women give their, literally put their lives on the line for each other's countries. And that continues. The sad part is in the United States, we're cutting funding for the forest management and cutting funding for forest fire mitigation or fighting. So that's not helping the situation in Canada or the US either. So what we really need to do is work together as two countries, not just to manage forests better, fight fires better, but to fight climate change better. That's the big reason this is happening in Canada and in the US. And unless we do this together, climate change will get worse and the fires will get worse. Pretty much guaranteed. There's not a lot of uncertainty there.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jonathan Overpeck, a climate scientist who leads the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. We're talking about wildfire season and climate change.
Well, we cannot reverse this easily. You're absolutely right. What we can do is stop it from getting worse.
More after a break. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's now continue our conversation with Jonathan Overpeck, the dean of the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan, and part of a Nobel Prize-winning team of climate scientists who warned the world 20 years ago about rising temperatures. He's published research on increasingly arid conditions in North America. We're talking today about massive forest fires and our changing climate. You know, as we've had these spurts of just really wild weather, the wildfire smoke is only part of it. The increased and more intense storms that you mentioned, the flooding. I've often heard people talk about the myriad of issues that are sort of dragging their attention right now and hear them say that they feel powerless on climate issues, especially with the federal government kind of digging in its heels right now, that they have lives to live and that they feel like they don't have any real agency in the battle that's going on. And I wonder what that brings up for you when you hear people say things like that.
Well, there are a lot of things we can do. And, the oil companies have long tried to pin it on individuals and their need to each do their part to solve this problem. But when we really come down to it, that's important. I have no problem with that. I drive an electric vehicle, I love it. I have solar on my house, I have geothermal. But really, what's most important for most people is to vote for climate action, to vote for more emphasis on the more affordable renewable energy and battery storage. Not only does that give you an economic payoff, less money for energy, it also gives you more reliable energy. In Ann Arbor, for example, a lot of people have gas generators by their house. I have batteries in my house, and so I just as good, if there's a power outage, I'm going to have power, but it's clean power, solar and batteries. So what we need to do at the same time that we're looking for what each of us can do, I'm lucky to have enough money to have the batteries and the solar, but what we really need to do is vote for political leaders who actually believe in climate change and promise to do something about it. Right now, I think the Republican Party is getting bought off by the oil industry, and I'm not saying which way to vote, but I want to see Republican and Democrats working together to fight climate change.
A lot of folks hearing us may be aware that the Trump administration has reversed any number of federal policies that have to do with climate change, both in terms of encouraging renewable fuels and also in some ways, just stopping the policy change that took years to put into place. How would you describe the way that some of the other nations, highly developed nations, are responding to climate change in this moment?
Well, the country that's doing the most to fight climate change is China. They're now way ahead of the rest of the world in terms of the ability to produce the solar and battery storage that you need to fight climate and the electrified mobility, the EVs. They're way ahead of the US. They're way ahead of Europe. Europe is also doing very well, though, in terms of deploying the renewable energy and battery storage and EVs. Some countries like Norway are now selling virtually no internal combustion vehicles anymore. China has spent half of the cars that they're selling are electrified. And so the US is sort of a standing out among all of our industrialized leading countries of the world. And I'd add in Korea and Japan and other countries in Asia. We stand out as sort of a laggard in federal policy in this area. But it turns out that wind, solar, and battery storage and EVs are all becoming economically the number one choice for energy production and transportation. So, in other words, it's cheaper if you go with these alternative, non-polluting technologies. And they're just getting cheaper and cheaper. And obviously, fossil fuels, particularly natural gas and oil, are getting more and more expensive, in part because of the war, but in part because they're commodities that just aren't going to get cheaper. Coal is already too expensive. It's foolish to build more coal, and that's why we're not building more coal. And I think it's also interesting to note that almost all of the new energy that we're putting on the grid in America is renewable energy because it's cheaper and it's faster. And that's what we need in our economy today, where electricity demand is going up really fast. So politically, they're trying really hard to talk the talk. The oil companies want us to talk, but in reality, renewable energy, battery storage, it's the wave of the future. The only thing that really bothers me is that by not having federal industrial policy supporting electrified mobility, renewable energy, and battery storage, we're kind of losing out on the global market for this stuff because this is what everyone around the world, Africa, South America, Asia, is now buying for their energy. And America's kind of sitting on the sidelines because of our federal policy. And that's really like a forced error on the part of the U.S. economy.
How do you think about the goalposts for this right now? I don't think I've heard anyone suggest that it would be possible to fully reverse the warming of the planet within our lifetime to, say, pre-industrial levels. But what do you think is a realistic way to look at change within the next 20 years or so?
Well, we cannot reverse this easily. You're absolutely right. What we can do is stop it from getting worse. That is what we have to do. As long as we put greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide from burning of fossil fuels, as long as we put more molecules of CO2, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere, it will get warmer. We know that with confidence. So we have to stop doing that and stabilize the climate. Then there are ways we can start to try and cool it back down, but that could take a centuries. It's not an easy task, and we have no sort of technological way to do that. So the focus has to just be on stopping the climate change as fast as we can, because we're already at unsafe levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's why we're getting the flooding. That's why we're getting the fires. That's why we're getting the heat waves. And they will all continue to get worse and more devastating if we don't do the job.
Professor Jonathan Overpeck is Dean of the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for talking to us about this today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Social media has been both a blessing and a curse for Michigan's public lands and wild spaces. On the one hand, the images of moss-covered boulders, thick tree canopies, and rushing rivers draw so many of us out to enjoy nature and to remember to connect with our natural resources. And also the increased foot traffic. Sometimes the high numbers of people who come out when they've seen a viral video can harm sensitive species and even really change the landscape. Sherry McWhorter covered one such space and one such story for M Live. This is the so-called Narnia Trail on the eastern side of the Upper Peninsula. Sherry, welcome back to Stateside. Good to have you.
Thank you so much. Always good to be here.
So for those who haven't visited, I mean, I feel like the name kind of says it all, but how would you describe the Narnia Trail?
Well, I like to call it the Bush Bay Trail, which is what its actual name is. But I would describe it as magical. Even now in its damaged state, it is magical. There are these enormous dolomite limestone boulders everywhere. Moss is growing all over them. And it creates a real deep forest feel when you walk into it. You can feel the temperature decrease when you walk into that dense canopy. It's a really spectacular Great Lakes coastal wetland habitat, something that every Michigander should want to see and should be able to.
This place, the Bush Bay Trail, it's near Cedarville. I mean, how accessible is it in terms of location?
Well, it's not hard to get to. I was able to cross the bridge, turn east at St. Ignace. You go just past Cedarville, and they've created a parking lot on the side of the highway. But the thing is that this property, this trail, is on private property. So there's only so much parking available. And when there's really too many people there, the parking can get backed up, flowing outside of the parking area, out onto the highway, creating hazardous conditions for people that are just trying to drive back and forth. So there's a lot of issues with this beautiful trail's incredible popularity.
I take it that the name is probably very descriptive of the kind of vibes that people might get as they're hiking.
Incredibly. Now, I must admit here that I never read any C.S. Lewis, but as I've heard it described, it's very fitting name. It was a nickname that was given to the trail decades ago by people who attended a local church camp a couple properties away, and they would hike in and appreciate the area and drew obvious connections to the literary reference, the C.S. Lewis book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
When did you notice, Sherry, that, you know, the kids had found it, it was going viral?
Well, I started to notice the social media posts about it in recent years. Ever since the pandemic, more and more people have been getting outside, and that is wonderful. We in Michigan have some of the best access to public spaces that are beautiful environmental surroundings, and it's wonderful that more people are getting out there. The trouble is that not everybody has been taught the principles of leave no trace, of not harming those environments that we are welcome to go into. The notion of leaving a place even better than you found it. That's the struggle that they're having at the Bush Bay Trail.
Yeah. What did you learn from land managers about what's going on and how the increased traffic is really affecting the land?
Well, the numbers are pretty shocking. This little tiny trail in the eastern UP went from seeing about 5,000 visitors a year to as many as an estimated 50,000 visitors.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's a tenfold increase on a tiny little trail that's covered in moss. And I understand the notion of wanting to run and frolic in the forest. I get it. As an environmental reporter, there is nothing I enjoy more than frolicking in the forest. I try to stick to the designated trails because I've been taught those leave no trace principles. The notion that every time you step off the trail, you might be stepping on a delicate moss or lichen or wildflower. You might be stepping on a tree seedling that will be harmed simply by your footstep. Leave no trace principles encourage people to stay on designated trails. When you're camping, to choose areas that have already been camped on to minimize new damage to natural areas. And never leave behind trash or even trinkets, which is something that was happening there at the Bush Bay Trail.
Can you say more about why that in and of itself would be a problem? I mean, some people would say, "What the heck? I mean, it's just a little charm that I left here. Like, why might that become an issue?"
Well, according to Leave No Trace principles, it's technically considered litter.
Yeah, right.
It's plastic. It doesn't belong in the natural environment. And even if it's only there temporarily, any plastic left outdoors breaks down. We don't want microplastics breaking down and going into our natural areas, especially areas that are so ecologically unique. This place isn't just a cool mossy spot. It also has these very sensitive habitats there called the alvar. It's where this dolomite limestone is kind of exposed. It's part of the Niagara escarpment. And exposed limestone gets these little pock marks on it, right? From the rain over years. And in those little pock marks of the limestone, little mosses and other plants take root and grow out of it. And that's how you end up with spaces where these giant boulders are covered in big pillowy mosses, and they have trees growing out of the top of them, actual cedar trees growing out of a boulder because they were rooted in this special limestone. And so the notion of people jumping off trail and frolicking across an open limestone area, it looks like it's no big deal. It looks like it might just be an open rocky area. But it's very sensitive in terms of the ecology, the plant life, the microorganisms there. What the Nature Conservancy is trying to do there is really to educate folks about the importance of staying on the trail, looking with your eyes, taking photos, take those selfies, but don't go off the trail to do it. Don't stomp on the plants and the mosses to do it. Don't climb on the boulders. Because they've caused so much damage to the mosses that they've literally pulverized them.
Yeah.
When you walk into this certain area on the Narnia Trail, you can see the gorgeous mosses growing along the sides of these big boulders. But when you look up at the top of the boulders, you can see that there's no moss anymore. It's all darkened and blackened. All the moss has sloughed off from all of the foot traffic. People have trampled it. So they've trampled the thing that they've gone to see, to experience. That's the opposite. That is the antithesis of the leave no trace principle. If you really appreciate the environment, if you really want to have those experiences, it's important to do it in a way where you're not harming the environment around you and you're leaving it in just as good a quality for the next person to come along and enjoy it as well.
Sherry, this feels like it's been a recurring story, particularly since COVID. You know, it's amazing that so many more people have reconnected and remembered what incredible natural assets are all over Michigan. And there's been this boom in regional travel that really hasn't come back down. Do you see any way that conservationists can internalize the increased interest? Like, how is the Nature Conservancy trying to get the word out to people?
They're doing things on the ground first at the trail. They're going to install some boardwalks in areas that are especially trampled. But it's the signage. They're adding signs. And the signs that they're adding don't just say things like, stay on the trail, don't climb on boulders. They say, stay on the trail because we don't want you to trample the wildflowers. Don't climb the boulders because we don't want you to destroy the mosses. It explains why they're asking people to do something. And I think that that extra level of education is going to make the difference. I don't think people want to destroy beautiful things. I think some people just don't know when they are destroying beautiful things. So, by and large, I think people can be educated out of this problem. If everybody works towards educating people in their lives about how to appreciate the environment and to do it without harming it, I think we'll all be better off.
Sherry McWhorter reports for M Live, and you can read her recent story about the Bush Bay Trail near Cedarville, better known as the Narnia Trail, at the M Live website right now. Sherry, thank you so very much for talking to us.
So happy to be here.
We need to take a break here. When we come back, Congresswoman Haley Stevens makes her case for a U.S. Senate seat.
Michiganders are getting the short end of the stick, and it's not acceptable. And I have joined them in leading legislation to hold DTE accountable to lowering rates. And if they're not going to do it, they're going to lose federal funds.
She'll take questions on a wide variety of issues ahead of August's Democratic primary. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. August's Democratic primary election in Michigan has captured national media attention. Voters and analysts are expecting to learn a lot about the mood and temperature of the Democratic Party with the outcome of the primary for an open U.S. Senate seat. The two leading candidates are Congresswoman Haley Stevens, who represents a swath of Oakland County north of Detroit, and Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, who's worked in public health for Detroit and Wayne County. We'll be talking with El-Sayed tomorrow. Today, Congresswoman Haley Stevens. Haley Stevens, welcome.
Thank you.
Having experience gives a candidate an edge often over opponents, but there are candidates who benefit from outsider image. Is there anything that you would want to say to voters who maybe see you as more of an establishment person rather than someone who has their best interests at heart?
Well, I'd say that the time that we are in right now is so very serious. And what led me to putting up my hand to run for United States Senate instead of staying comfortable in the House seat that I was in, that I could have run for re-election in, is because a fully paralyzed veteran reached out to me last year when he saw Elon Musk with the chainsaw and asked if he was still going to get his benefit check. A Michigan fully paralyzed veteran. It's not the time to be comfortable. And it's also the time to be engaging in our country's democracy, the deliberations for who's going to stand up and fight for us. I think this has been a really healthy and incredible process. It's been important for Democrats as well.
I want to ask you about an issue that has been very concerning to a lot of voters, immigrations and customs enforcement, and also customs and border protection actions to implement the Trump administration's mandates. Some candidates have called for abolition of ICE or CPB or CBP, and you're one of those who actually calls for reforms rather than abolition. What issues should be addressed first?
Yeah, look, I don't think slogans or shouting into the bullhorn totally gets us out of this mess. We need to tackle head-on accountability. ICE agents from top to bottom who have committed crimes need to be held accountable. I have legislation to create a special prosecutor to do that. I have also used my current position to stop the funds that are going into this corruption and abuse of power.
Let's move into an aspect of foreign policy. The war in Iran and some of the previous engagements that our allies have had in Gaza and Lebanon have raised questions about the degree to which U.S. foreign policy and national security priorities are being kept separate from those of our allies, in this case, Israel. What would you say to skeptics who may believe that you are not the person to influence the relationship?
Well, look, Donald Trump has been completely out of control. He's got Napoleonic visions globally. He started an illegal war in Iran totally outside the bounds of the Constitution. Americans, Michiganders, do not want that war, are paying the price for that war. And in terms of what motivates my work in the Congress and what is motivating my run for United States Senate, it is to push back on these abuses of power from Donald Trump and to make sure that Michigan is heard and getting a fair shake. We are getting screwed by Donald Trump's erratic tariffs, a rejection of proven 21st century industrial policy. Now, you mentioned Israel and longstanding Democratic alliance and some deep frustration around the failure of the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to bring us closer to the goal of peace. He has failed in that regard, and it needs to be called out. And we also need to continue to push for humanitarian aid, rebuilding of Gaza and Lebanon, and a two-state solution that brings peace and dignity to Palestinian people who have suffered tremendously because of this war and because of Hamas's leadership. And I think we need a two-state solution. That's how I'm always going to use my vote.
The American or Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, has spent a lot in this primary and has spent directly $9.3 million in support of you as a candidate and a total of $15 million on the race to this point, and we're only in primary season. What would you say this says about how AIPAC views Abdul and yourself?
Look, I'd say this, that anyone who's individually supporting me and my campaign is doing so because of my track record around fighting for Michigan, delivering for Michigan. There is a huge and an extraordinary problem in our country with outside money. This has been going on for a very long time. When I first ran for Congress, the only, you know, quote, outside money that got involved was through party committees. And now we're at a place where we see outside spending from a variety of groups. This is why I have been putting in reforms and voting and co-sponsoring legislation. And I'm being entirely transparent with the voters of Michigan about what I want to do when I get to the United States Senate and who I am. I'm a public servant fighting for us.
You didn't feel pressed to return donations from AIPAC or maybe other groups. I understand that the campaign cannot control money that's spent outside of your own coffers, but you did not feel moved to return any of the donations, even when they've been questioned.
You know, I have received tremendous support from individuals across Michigan. I'll tell you that there was an event with a women's event with the party, primarily around Black women. And I was attending. I was excited to be there. And a gal approached me and she said, "I brought this for you." And it was a check for $100. And it was what she could contribute, what she could give. And I'm proud of, you know, how I've approached my campaign, how it's grassroots, and how my sleeves are rolled up and how I've run all my campaigns.
Haley, can you give us an example of how you have opposed the Netanyahu administration's policies in your time in Congress?
Yeah, well, I've certainly stood up for the folks in the Palestinian community in the West Bank and called out some of the extreme settler violence. But most importantly, the deep, deep work I've done in the Congress, very unlikely situation that I fell into with my constituent, Paul Whelan, who was taken by the Russians. And Paul is an incredible individual, started engaging in hostage efforts across the Congress and the co-chair of the hostage task force. As we know, on October 7th, hundreds of innocent civilians, nine Americans were taken by Hamas, put into tunnels. And I worked regularly with colleagues. I led a resolution 414-0. Every voting member of Congress joined me to condemn Hamas, call for the release of the hostages. Those families, some who were American, deeply frustrated with Netanyahu, deeply frustrated with his government. And I joined them in that frustration. I worked tirelessly alongside them on behalf of our country, our Congress, and free and fair people who did not feel as though their government or a government was working effectively on their behalf. I really encourage voters and listeners to, if this is an area of interest, to look into that more. I could talk on and on, but I will tell you that this is another example of where folks felt failed by Mr. Netanyahu.
Let's bring it back around to domestic matters. As you know, data centers are in the works in many communities around Michigan. How do you think the federal government should change the way it regulates data centers or AI processes more generally?
Well, look, Michiganders are getting the short end of the stick, and it's not acceptable. And I have joined them in leading legislation to hold DTE accountable to lowering rates. And if they're not going to do it, they're going to lose federal funds. Data centers are being built off of the backs of our hard work and our taxpayer dollars, and our rates are only going up, and it's not acceptable. And I am calling it out now. I'm leading efforts now to support hardworking Michiganders, and I plan to do that only in a bigger and more ferocious way from the United States Senate.
Would you support a moratorium?
Well, look, as a federal lawmaker, I'd have to see the legislation. I don't know what exactly that looks like, not in part because I'm trying to shapeshift. This is a state issue. This is a local issue. You know, I don't like making false statements that actually can't be achieved from my role. I thought it was interesting what New York did, which is they did a 1 year to say, hey, let's get all this stuff right. Here's the other problem, though. We have 50 data centers already built. So, and I see Donald Trump gutting the Environmental Protection Agency. I see the Great Lakes Water Authority without the resources to build new pipes. What the heck's going on here? So I'm going to fully fund the personnel for EPA and water safety and safety in and around our communities so that Michiganders are protected. So you can say a moratorium. That's interesting. But what do we do about the ones that have already been built?
Let's talk about healthcare. As you know, there's been some churn in the incentives that have supported the Affordable Care Act. And the result of that is that Michiganders are paying a lot more for their health care packages when they're self-funding, if they're paying for them at all. A lot of people have just dropped out of the Affordable Care Act market. And costs for other health plans supported by employers are also up. Is there legislation you would propose or support that would fix a health care system that a lot of people experience as broken?
Yeah, Michiganders haven't just dropped out. They've been pushed out. And they have gotten screwed over by Donald Trump. And the tax bill that gave $70 billion to ICE, gave a tax write-off to billionaires, and slashed the tax subsidies. We can also look at what's gone on with Medicaid, which has been unconscionable and wrong. I want to see us expand Medicaid. I am very proud to have taken on pharmaceutical and drug companies to cap the price of prescription drugs, particularly insulin, at $35 a month. And I'll tell you about a Detroit restaurant owner who I was talking to the other day. I was asking about his health care because I know that restaurants are small businesses and, you know, they a lot of times are strapped and not able to offer health care to their employees or even to themselves, and they go on the exchange. And I was asking him what he wanted to see. And he told me, he said, I don't know if I'll ever believe it to see our healthcare system get fixed. That is a darn shame. You know, I have a deep background in industrial policy, manufacturing policy. I stood behind President Biden when he signed the CHIPS Act into law. I played a lead role in getting that legislation done, and I'm darn proud of it. By the way, there was tons of investment into STEM equity and equal education opportunities in that legislation, something that Donald Trump has now completely cut. Why is our healthcare system so complicated? Why? Why not say that $100 a person every year? I mean, add that up.
Am I hearing you in support of single payer?
You know, look, I'd say this. that we've got to work within the system that we have, but we got to stop these big insurance companies from robbing us blind. And there's one path, you know, that I spend a lot of time talking to stakeholders about, and it is this deep frustration with insurance companies. I think going into litigation and lawsuits and more disruption may not be the answer. But I will tell you, the Medicare challenges of who gets signed up and how they get signed up, and if they don't do it in the right window and then they're left without the proper coverage, Social Security recipients seeing a slight cost of living increase just to see their healthcare costs go up, something is deeply broken here. Quality. Quality and access and affordability is very key here. I want this American experiment to work, but right now it is not.
There's a question that we probably could have spent this entire time talking about, and that is just the cost of living in Michigan right now. What can one senator do to bring costs down?
Well, look, again, I'm not in the business of slogans. We all know that the costs are too damn high. Here are our indicators. 60% of Americans now living paycheck to paycheck. Something that I have been eyeing for the last handful of years is the ballooning consumer debt and default rates. As someone who was in the Department of the Treasury during the Great Recession, working on the auto rescue, which was across the hall from the home ownership affordability and saving people's homes office, I will tell you that this keeps me up at night. How I lower costs, I believe, has to be a multi-pronged approach as a U.S. senator. Here's what I'm offering to the people of Michigan. No tariffs on groceries. I started talking about this, and you immediately saw the administration start to take those steps. That needs to become law, because those grocery prices and our farmers who aren't getting any benefit from it, it's wrong, and we can address it. Two, the taking on these utility companies, Prolonged Power Outage Relief Act. I've got that legislation. I've had it for years. Wrote it to provide relief and to take on these utility companies when they're raising rates. We just have to get aggressive. I cannot see Michigan residents continue to get double taxed. Three, big, bold bill that I have, Unearth America's Future Act. Lessen our dependence on China for critical minerals and components throughout our supply chain, create jobs here, and lower costs because we save on shipping. That's real industrial policy, not this crap we're getting from Trump, which is taking on Canada when he promised to take on China. That's also raising rates. Let's be very clear. Small business revenues in Michigan are down 40% in a lot of communities because of this trade war with Canada.
Haley, the available polling we have show you ahead of your primary opponent at this point. However, a statistically significant number of voters are still undecided for August's primary. Voters with less information may just be wading in, maybe looking at the socials to see, you know, what you stand for and what you're like. There have been clips circulating with tone and mannerisms where you are definitely fired up. Some might even say a little over the top. Is there anything that you would want to say to people who are just getting to know you in this way at this stage of voting?
Well, I have no problem laughing at myself. I've been having some roll on the floor laughing moments with some of my best friends about clips circulating on the internet. And obviously, it's no laughing matter what we're going through in Michigan. But I am an extrovert's extrovert. I really thrive off the energy of people and what our state is all about and connecting with people. And look, as voters are making up their mind in this Democratic primary, I win primaries and I win tough general elections. That is what I have done time and time again. And so it is very humbling. It is very energizing for me to go out there and earn the rest of the remaining votes. It's amazing that we've got this absentee process in Michigan. I feel very strongly about voting rights, ongoing civil rights, and what is on the line. Mike Rogers will be a roadblock. I will beat him. I will eat his lunch and breakfast and a little bit of his dinner on all these issues. And together, we will make Michigan shine.
Rep. Stevens, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We hope you can join us again tomorrow. Take care.